This is Startup for the Rest of Us, episode 77.
Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, a podcast that helps developers, designers, and entrepreneurs be awesome at launching startups, whether you've built your first one
or you're just thinking about it.
I'm Rob.
And I'm Mike.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. What's the word this week, Mike?
Well, I'm in Canada.
Canada? Vancouver?
Calgary, to be exact.
Awesome. Is it chilly up there?
It's not too bad. It's about 40s, 50s right now.
Well, cool. Yeah, I got a couple things I wanted to revisit. I was actually listening to episode 75, which is two episodes ago. And do you remember we had the question about someone was thinking about starting an idea that was $99 a month, and it was catering to retailers with closeout merchandise?
Yeah, I remember that.
And we were kind of batting ideas back and forth about it. And as I was listening to it, I realized, why didn't we suggest to really differentiate? Because I was trying to think, why was this idea any different than Craigslist? Why wouldn't a retailer put their stuff on eBay? And the way that he would have to penetrate this market, I think, would be to hire someone, or do it himself for the first few months, hire someone to go on site and actually snap the photos and post the stuff for free. And that would be the differentiator, right? And it would be up to X items per month for $99, and then it'd be X dollars for each additional one. Or you could have tiered plans as well. But I just realized that like that could actually be a differentiator, right? Is the reason they would keep them from putting their stuff on Craigslist or eBay is just purely the labor aspect of it.
That's not a bad idea, because then you could charge them to essentially come on site and do that stuff for them. But then you're introducing a labor component on your own side.
I know. There's a lot of it doesn't scale that well. It's definitely not like a super highly scalable business.
You know what? I think you could probably use it to target people who are in the photo industry who are hard up for work and just try and get them to go do these jobs on your behalf. And obviously, they'd have to upload the photos and enter stuff into your software, but you could pay them by the hour. And how long could it possibly take to do 25 or 50 items? Because you're charging more for more items, then you could certainly use that to judge what your costs are, especially in that startup phase.
You're saying almost like crowdsource it, like just have kind of a workforce, piecemeal workforce out there. A job goes out and people can claim it and go do it, rather than have someone that you, even a contractor that you have on staff, just kind of have photographers, people who know how to take pictures out there doing it.
A little bit of both. I think initially you'd have to do it yourself or have somebody that you trust do it, because then you can kind of work out the bugs in that process. And then once you've kind of got that down, then you could essentially crowdsource that work out to people and then pay them that way.
Right. So cool. I don't know if the economics work at $99 a month, but anyways, that's just another 2 cents on that. By the way, if people are wondering why the call quality is kind of crummy, it's because you have crappy wireless at the hotel. So I'm calling Mike on a landline.
That's an understatement.
But hey, I have a couple other things. I noticed that there were a couple comments on episode 75. This was the same one about the $99 a month episode. Someone called A Startup. They said, "Hey, Casey, will the store make more than $100 a month using your site? I think that the amount is too much. If it's a big store, they already have a way to get rid of clearance for free, slick deals, and fat wallet." And those are websites, I assume, that they can list their stuff. And then someone named Mike Sickler says, "My idea would be to make it completely self-service for the merchants. They can sign up, enter their store details, such as their address, contact info, etc., and use a single rich text editor to enter their clearance items or specials. Nothing complicated." Now, there's actually a website that does this. It started by, you remember John Gallagher?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, he started it. And John, you're going to have to email me because I forget the URL, but we'll mention it in a future episode. But it's basically all it is a big text area when you go to the homepage, and you just paste a bunch of stuff in and it instantly like parses through it and lists all of that. Now, it doesn't have photos with it, but it is by far the quickest way to sell a lot of stuff online. Mike continues and he says, "Design a really sharp looking logo for your site and have window decals made. Each store would be sent two or three. Provide a couple of templates to the stores. Word docs are fine, so they can make their own flyers to publicize your site to their customers. Make it cheap and self-service, $20 a month. Market to municipal chambers of commerce. They love this kind of thing." So I think $20 a month is too cheap based on all that effort and the high touch that it's going to take to recruit merchants. And I've had worked with an entrepreneur who was working with chambers of commerce, and it sounds like a good idea, but chambers of commerce are kind of inundated with these kinds of things. So they do tend to be pretty choosy, and you really have to hold their hand and be on them for months. The sales cycle is very long. So I like that there's now been three or four different ideas. It's brainstorming time on this idea. I mean, you're not going to know until you try and it fails, and then you can try one of the other options.
The commenter on the startupsforrestless.com website, Mike, not me. Well, I'm still wrapping up a bunch of things for MicroConf, and my to-do list is pretty short, but I feel like I'm going to have a lot of random things that just kind of pop up here and there until the conference actually is over.
It's 20 days away. What did you possibly have that you still need to do?
Well, I got the USB keys have arrived, and I've got all the name badges and everything else, and I've got to print those out. And now that everything's kind of all in one spot, I can take a look at that stuff. And I'm just trying to gather all the digital materials from the sponsors and make sure that all that's straightened out, and so I can get that over to the conference workers who will load up the USB keys and hand them out.
Cool. Yeah, most of the stuff's also wrapping up on my end. I do still have a few small things to wrap up. So, hey, we got several new iTunes reviews. We'd really appreciate it if you'd head over there. Even in the last week, we had three or four new ones. And Scott Underwood said, awesome podcast, great podcast with awesome information for anyone looking to start their own web-based business or launch a software product. Keep up the great work. And then Ann Isadora said, this podcast is the one you want to hear. Imagine that. No crushing, no cussing, no get rich quick. Just two smart, level-headed guys who want to help. Thank God.
Yeah, she's talking about us there.
Yeah, I know. Well, thanks, Anne. We appreciate the compliment.
So this past weekend, I was pretty sick. It totally blew my entire Saturday out of the water. I've been leveraging my contract developer and my virtual assistant quite a bit more lately. And it was nice to see, like, on Sunday afternoon that things were still getting done, even though I wasn't around to actually do them.
No, that's the beauty of it, right? Is it's like, I don't work Fridays, and so the three-day weekend every week, it's great to kind of relax. It's not actually relaxing because I'm typically watching kids and I do answer emails and stuff. But I take a lot of joy or a lot of pride in coming back on Monday and seeing how much got done while I wasn't really doing anything on Fridays. It's this crazy feeling of like, it's almost like free work. I've always been at the mindset of like, you have to do the work for it to get done. And over the last few years, learning to outsource has become such a pleasant experience to come back and see things that are done and done well, and you don't even have to worry about them anymore.
Yeah, I think what I need to do next is find somebody who I can leverage as like a QA tester, because that's what I've spent a lot of my time doing. I'll hand it off to the developer and he'll do a bunch of work and then turns around and comes back to me, and I end up doing a lot of QA work on it and filing bugs and making sure that things are getting fixed.
Yep, I agree. That's the majority of stuff I do as well these days. So,
is that something you think you can outsource, or have you ever tried to?
I haven't tried, but it's on my list. So right now I'm working on getting a developer. I've gone through two or three different ones, and they've been so-so. I haven't really found the one I want to stick with long-term for Hittail specifically, but I have another guy who's starting, and he seems really good. He's basically in the middle of his first task, and once I get all that nailed down, because it is time-consuming to bring up a new person, once he starts doing some smaller projects and I have confidence in him, I absolutely am going to look for someone who can, a QA person who can learn the app, and I can basically just email and say, all right, 48 hours from now, I need this thing QA'd. Luckily, the app is not huge. So it's like you can QA the whole thing in a few hours. So assuming that we're going to do a release, it would be great to just have someone kind of on call who could do that in the evening. So yeah, I've just had it kind of as a back burner task to find someone who can help with that. So how about this week? What are we chatting about?
One question that keeps coming up in the Micropreneur Academy is that there aren't really any good niches left for going after that have a fair amount of traffic and low competition. And I think the problem with looking at things that way is just that there's always going to be competition. And it's about whether you can outmarket that competition or not, which is really the root of the problem. So I thought it'd be a good idea to talk about how to evaluate competition to determine whether or not you can outmarket them or not, to help you identify the markets that you want to go after.
Right. I mean, I think maybe 10 years ago, there were niches with actually zero competition, but I'm not sure that the world was ready for those niches yet. 37 Signals, when they came out with their SaaS app. Salesforce came out with their SaaS app. I mean, there were very few SaaS apps at the time, and really people were not that wild about paying monthly fees for these things. They weren't that wild about having their data hosted elsewhere, and they weren't that wild about not being able to reach it when they weren't online. And so as it becomes more mainstream to build web apps and to get these mobile apps, apps and all that stuff out there. Of course, over time, these, you know, even the niches fill up and someone creeps in. So yeah, you're right. There's going to be very few niches with zero competition.
So the first one that I thought about was being able to calculate the total potential SEO traffic for a site. And one of the ways you can do that is to use AdWords and basically just add up a bunch of the numbers for all the different keywords that you'd be targeting. And then beyond that, you'd want to add even more based on whether or not their traffic is SEO driven or whether it's partner site or directory driven. The little bit more is going to depend a lot on the type of website. So if it's more high touch sales, then chances are that they're not going to get a lot of SEO traffic that directly drives those sales. And especially if they're using a lot of affiliates, then you're not going to find that the SEO traffic is going to go to them as well.
Yeah, I talk about this in my book and then again in the Academy, and I have kind of it's a fast and loose formula that I derive in the book for how I estimate markets. And I mean, it's as good as any that I've found. Frankly, there aren't that many out there. But the whole idea is that you look at SEO traffic and then figure out, is that what this company's based on? Or, you know, is at least 25% of their traffic coming from that, or 50%. You try to estimate it, and then you try to do some math from there. And for a lot of sites, it winds up being pretty even. They'll get like a third of their traffic from SEO, a third from direct, and then a third from referral traffic. Over time, if you have kind of a basic niche software product, that will tend to be the direction it heads, as long as at least some people are searching for it, and you're not in a niche that's really offline. If you market to like construction companies, then your percentage of SEO traffic is going to be tiny, tiny. I'd say it's 5%, 10%. But if you market to, you know, say web designers or any niche photographers, I mean, even just niches that do tend to be heavy online, you can easily get to 50% or more as your percentage of SEO traffic.
So the next part of that is using other sites to get a better handle on what kind of competition they are. So another way you can try and find out what kind of competition they are is using sites like Compete.com. And Compete.com will allow you to plug in a URL or a website name, and it'll essentially give you a roundabout estimate of what they feel that the traffic levels are for that. And if the site that you've targeted doesn't have a statistically relevant sample, then that's probably a good thing. A good thing in terms of the fact that that site probably doesn't have a lot of heavy traffic, but on the other side, you may, since you're targeting a niche market, chances are good that it may not have enough traffic for Compete.com to even really be looking at that niche.
Right. And all of these tips, they kind of fit together to give you a little bit more insight into your competition. Each of these gives you just a tiny bit more insight. No one of them should be a single red flag or like an open gate to just come and attack this niche. All of these have to work in tandem because each of them has a margin of error. I'm actually looking at Compete.com right now, and I just did it on my blog. And my blog last month, I think it got 20,000 uniques, and Compete says 3,500. So obviously that's off, right, by a factor of 5 in this case. And other times it's been off by a little more. If I get a big spike in traffic, Compete just doesn't tend to notice that. But this does give you an idea, especially for larger sites. It tends to be a little more accurate. It's not going to track spikes, but you can tell if someone is at 100,000 uniques or 10,000 uniques or 1,000 unique. I mean, that's really kind of those are the levels that you're looking for. And I do find that Compete, while it can be way off, used in tandem with all these other ideas we're going to be talking about, it can just be one more piece of that picture.
Yeah, and that's definitely a good point to mention, is that you're just looking to get in the right ballpark. I mean, are you within a factor of 10? And if you are, that's probably okay. You don't want to be off by a factor of 100, but if you're within that factor of 10, then in combination with all of the other things, then it gives you a ballpark estimation of how much traffic they're getting.
Right. And I mean, if you think about 15, 20 years ago, doing this kind of research would be really, really hard. It was just such an opaque world without the internet. And so you could either not do this altogether, or you'd have to spend $100,000 to hire a firm to do it, or it just wasn't available information. So the fact that in, you know, a matter of 20, 30 minutes, you can probably go down and do all the things that we're going to mention here, and to get at least a reasonably blurry picture, it's way, way better than what we could have had 15 years ago. So
right. And that's just to help you get that gut check. It's not, as you said, it's not meant to be perfect.
Right.
So the next thing to do is look at the Whois records for the domain. And if the domain has been around for a while, but the sales content on the site hasn't changed a lot, then chances are pretty good that the site is being pretty well neglected.
Yeah, often you can see this like in the copyright notice at the bottom of a site, or, you know, there's a last change date like a modified date on files depending on the web server. But I've done this before. I've actually, you know, you go to Google and type in find out last change date for a HTML file. And you can find a tool, plug in a URL, and it'll go and ping the server. And if the server will give you that information, it's kind of cool to find out, wow, they have not updated this site for 4 years. And like you said, that's just a little more insight into, huh, these guys either are just coasting on a gravy train and there's no other competition, or they've kind of bowed out altogether, you know, and they're not really using their website as a marketing channel.
Yeah, and one of the things that makes doing some of this a little bit difficult is you don't necessarily have a good picture of when the website was changed. I mean, it may have changed 6 weeks ago, and it still just looks like it's from 1997. Well, you can use sites like the Wayback Archive.
Archive.org.
Archive.org, yeah. And if they have old copies of that site, I mean, they won't have images or anything like that, but it will be able to tell you within a reasonable time frame when different updates were made to that site, and you'll basically be able to look at what is almost a calendar to show you the number of updates that were made to that site and when those updates were made.
I have a question. So we've talked about looking at your competition, like looking at your competitors' websites.
Mm-hmm.
What's the best way to find those websites in the first place?
I would probably start by looking at the keywords that you plan on targeting for whatever that niche is. So if you're, I don't know, looking at invoicing software, you type in invoicing software. But I would probably start by going back to Google AdWords and start looking to see what things people are searching for. Because you're probably going to derive most of your business, or at least attempt to derive most of it, from search engines.
Well, I think that's at least a starting point, right? I mean, I think some of the businesses that people are going after are much less SEO focused.
It gives you a starting point, and that's really right. The idea. And once you get at least one or two competitors that you're able to look at, then you can kind of expand your focus a little bit from there, because not every competitor is going to be focused on exactly the same problem that you're trying to solve. I mean, some of them are going to be close, but not quite what you do. But basically,
right,
you're just looking for related search terms, I'll say.
Cool.
So the next one is to go and start looking at their support forums if they have any, and you can use those to judge the company responsiveness to problems. If those forums are stagnant, then they might not be getting as much traffic as you think they are.
Honestly, I feel like forums have just gone out of style. Like, a lot of new SaaS apps don't have forums anymore. Have you noticed that?
Yeah, I have.
I just think that's an indication of the way things, kind of support has changed.
I think forums have gone more the social route than the support route.
Right. I mean, I think like when people are building online communities, they're often like they're building them more on Twitter. Some people build them around Facebook. And I think forums were intended both to help with support originally, as well as to build a community around your product and get people talking about, you know, different ways to use it and trying to help each other out. And I can't think of the last new app that has launched in the past several years that also launched with a big, you know, forum attached to it. And it just seems kind of like that's a walled garden these days, and like being on a, you know, a social network. So even using something like User Voice, who's a MicroConf sponsor, by the way, I think is a better approach these days.
I think part of the original basis for forums was to bring that kind of a culture out of Usenet and into, I guess, the rest of the world, because not a lot of non-techies, I'll say, were using Usenet. So
right,
it was more to make it web-enabled and grew into kind of a whole business. And then people said, oh, well, what else can I use this for? And it was back in the early days of the Internet. And that's where its roots are, and then it just got used for support forums and things like that. But there are people who still use them.
Oh, sure. But I mean, even like with Hittail, it had forums, and I shut them down after I took it over. And .NET Invoice, we've had forums since I bought it, and we actually are shutting them down this week. I mean, they've been okay for support, but frankly, we'd rather have people email us. It's just easier to deal with. It's easier to track, to kind of have one input and output coming out. And then if we really want to engage and build a community, it's just much easier to do in a social area like Twitter or Facebook or, you know, another network where you can engage the whole world and not just have, you know, people having to come to your website to do it. So
is the conclusion we're coming to is that if they have support forums, then they're probably not
following the latest startup trends, I mean, for whatever that's worth. But definitely you can tell if the forums, the last post was a couple years ago, obviously gives you an indicator that it's probably not an active product.
Mm-hmm. So the next is to do some simple Google searches for the keywords that you're after and see if the competitors that you're looking at even rank. And you can use a lot of different tools for checking to see where their rankings are. You can use SEO mods, you can use Woosh traffic, or a number of other tools to track it. And you can do this typically on sites that you don't even own, because all you're doing is you're plugging in keywords and you're finding out where those websites rank in Google for those keywords.
Right. So if you want to do a quick check, you know, we used to use scroogle.org, but Google shut them down. Mm-hmm. So now I hit a Control-Shift-N in Chrome, and that gives you a new incognito window, which means you're not logged in and there's no history tied to it. So now I'm finding myself hitting Control-Shift-N like 20 times a day anytime I want to check where I rank or anyone else ranks for a keyword, and I don't want all of Google's personalized junk in there. So you can also do that just for one-offs. But yeah, if you want to track competition over time, once you're actually in a niche, then you definitely want to get their information into one of those tools you mentioned.
Yeah, the other thing that I find those tools useful for is if they're not ranked on the first or second page and you don't feel like going that far down to try and find where they are, then that's where those tools become a lot more useful. But as you said, it's more for tracking those things over time. Something else you can do is you can view the page source for their web pages and see if they've done things that used to help you out but now don't do so as much anymore. So, for example, if they use the meta keyword tags in their HTML, those used to actually serve some useful purpose in Google, and Google would kind of look at them and would use those in ranking you, but they've come out and they've said, no, we don't do that anymore. And people tend to be aware that those keywords don't do anything, and they essentially just tell your competition what keywords you're targeting. So if they have those things in there and they're trying to target those, then chances are good that they probably don't necessarily know a lot about SEO, or they're just new at it. And both of those things kind of bode well for the niche that you're looking at.
Or they're old at it, because I definitely have some sites that are still up that have been up for years that I haven't gone in and deleted all the keywords from. So obviously something probably to have a VA do, but that could be the other case.
So one thing that I've also found useful is going to a competitor site and not even actually looking at it, but just kind of browsing to it and then looking off to the side of the monitor and just seeing if there's anything that comes into your field of vision on the website that draws your eyes to it, and then just look at that. And obviously there's tools out there to tell you what people are looking at on a particular website, but you don't usually want to pay for them for, you know, somebody else's website. And a lot of them use embedded JavaScript, so you wouldn't be able to use it for a competitor's website. But what you're really looking for is just telltale signs that the person who's running the site is trying to direct people through the site. And if they're not doing a good job of that, then typically their conversions are not going to be as good as they could be. Another telltale sign of this is if this website looks like it's stuck in the 90s.
You know, this is tough, because there are some businesses that are built just without the internet marketing part in place, right? They don't need that. They don't use it for lead gen. They're either doing more offline marketing, or they just have referrals, or they have affiliates, and they don't actually need to have all this stuff in place. But if you are going to actually be going after, you know, more of an online marketing type approach to this niche and aren't going to be doing, you know, a lot of the offline stuff, then this is stuff you need to think about.
Yeah, and that's a good lead into the last thing, which is to try and figure out what kind of sales model they're actually using. I mean, if they're doing everything online, or they're doing everything offline, or they're using referrals or affiliates to help generate traffic and sales, some of those things are a lot more difficult to determine how effective they are at those sales models. So if they're running affiliate programs, you might want to sign up for those affiliate programs, see what kind of statistics they can provide about how well their affiliates should be doing. Most of them will have a good idea and will be able to tell you, oh, well, if you put up a website, our affiliates, 85% of our affiliates are doing at least X dollar amount or have this type of conversion rate. So they'll be able to tell you those things. But at this point, you're really starting to go down the path of spending a lot more time of evaluating that niche. And at this point, you should probably have a good idea of whether or not it's a viable niche to go after, and you're really just finalizing the last details to figure out whether or not it's something that you want to compete head-to-head against them with.
Yeah, I think you can also tell a lot about how a company does business and how they do their marketing based on their pricing. Oftentimes I'll go to a site and, you know, if the pricing is $500 a month, then I know that they probably have high touch sales, definitely doing phone calls, doing webinars and doing that kind of stuff. And if they're charging $9.99 for something, then I would guess that, yeah, their support's probably not the greatest, or they're undercharging, they don't quite know what their product's worth. There's in between, of course, but you can start to look at the different pricing plans they offer and how they space things out to get an idea of, A, do these guys know what they're doing? Do I feel like these prices are reasonable and not undercut? And B, do they even list their pricing on their website? Because if you go there and it's call for pricing, then you know that they're kind of in that model of, you know, essentially having a customer call and then having the salesperson find out how much you're willing to pay or able to pay, and basically doing the enterprise sale, $5,000 and up type of sale. So that can tell you that if that's the only competitors in a market are doing that kind of thing, then perhaps there is room for someone to be below that market.
37 Signals. I mean, there's a prime example.
I mean, there's examples of a lot of people that have done this, right? They go in with a SaaS approach. They basically go in with a cheaper price than you would expect to pay if you were to go out and buy the full-blown enterprise version. 37 Signals is a great example of they built Basecamp, which is CRM software. And it's like, what other CRM software can you get for, I don't even know what they sell for these days, but when they started, it was probably $19 a month, I'd imagine. I'm sure it was a pretty low price. And at the time, CRM software was like hundreds of thousands of dollars.
And there were a lot of them, too. I mean, there was Goldmine, Salesforce was an option, Act was an option. I mean, Salesforce was all online as well, but both Act and Goldmine are not necessarily cheap either. I mean, you're going to pay, I think I bought a copy of Act at one point, and it was $300.
Right.
And that was for one user license.
Right. And the same for like analytics software, like for websites. I mean, Google came in and wrecked the market by going free, but there was similar stuff going on there where it was like $100,000 to get good analytics. And then was it Irken that came out? And it was, I think it was like either a small fee or it was a monthly fee. And there were a couple other services that came out. And so a lot of people have done this. They take what's only an enterprise market, and then they basically undercut them. And they don't, you can't just undercut on price and expect to win, but you actually have to undercut on price. And then you have to build a leaner product that isn't as complicated and doesn't take as high touch sales, right? It's like you have to be able to actually be more efficient at it in order to charge less and still make money. That all relates back to looking at prices and trying to get a gauge of how people are operating. The last way to get an idea of competition there's a couple websites that I've found pretty handy. We've talked about them before, but one is called SpyFu, and it's SpyFu. It's free with a paid version. It's kind of freemium. And you can enter a URL, and it'll give you different organic keywords and some paid keywords that SpyFu thinks that this website is targeting. And the other one is MixRank, which is very similar. You enter a URL, and then it gives you places that the website is advertising on. And so this just gives you an idea. Again, it's kind of like compete.com, where it's not going to be exact, but it can give you an idea of how much they might be spending on paid ads and what kind of keywords they are targeting, so that you can take a look at where they rank and how well their SEO is for those terms.
Well, I think that about wraps us up. If you have any question or comment, you can call it into our voicemail number at 1-888-801-9690, or you can email it to us at questions@startupsthestofus.com. Our theme music is an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups. You can subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or via RSS at startupsthestofus.com, where you'll also find a full transcript of the podcast. Thanks for listening. We'll see you next time.